50-minute hour. I'm your host, Dr. Zachary Friedman, licensed clinical psychologist and your guide and liaison to mental health. On today's show, episode 8, I have talked about it, I've hinted at it, I have cited it before, and here we finally are, psychodrama. A whole episode dedicated to talking about psychodrama. What is it? Where did it come from? How is it used? What does it even look like in the room? It is such a big subject that the interview had to be broken up into two episodes. So episode 8 and 9 are devoted to my interview with Dr. Brittany Lakin Starr, and they are broken in half. So today is part 1 of that interview. The second part of that episode is going to be aired in 2 weeks, so you'll have to wait for that episode then. On the show today, I interview Dr. Brittany Lakin Starr, also a licensed clinical psychologist. She is just shy of being a certified psychodramatist, so of all people to talk about, she is one of the best. She is highly knowledgeable on that subject, and she has tons and tons of experience. We talk about different examples. What does it look like in the room? She goes very thoroughly through the history. It's really just a great interview, and I hope you enjoy it. Two quick notes on the show. At one point during the interview, I say that psychodrama has been around for over 100 years. That is not accurate. Dr. Jacob Moreno, who started it, actually started dabbling in it around 1921. So if you do your math, that is not 100 years. Also, at one point during the interview, we reference Fritz Perls, and he is cited as a psychologist. He is, in fact, a psychiatrist. Dr. Brittany Lakin Starr actually noticed that after the fact, and we were talking about that, so she corrected me on that. We want to make sure we're not offending any hardcore Fritz Perls fans out there. You Perlsians, or whatever you refer to yourself as. This probably doesn't make sense yet, but hopefully during the interview, you will know what I'm talking about. Without further ado, here is my interview on psychodrama with Dr. Brittany Lakin Starr. Dr. Brittany Lakin Starr, so happy to have you on this show finally.
Thank you so much for having me, Dr. Friedman. It's so nice to be here.
So I am ready to have you on for many things because you know so many things. But today is we're going to focus on psychodrama. Part of the reason it's so great to have you on is that I keep mentioning this in other episodes. And I keep saying like, oh, that's related to psychodrama. I'll get back to that later. So now is that later. And you are the perfect person to come on the show and talk about this because you are a specialist in psychodrama. You are so very close, this close. And if you're not listening, or if you are listening, I hope you're listening. You can't see this, but my thumb and pointer finger are very, very close together. She is this close to being certified as a psychodramatist. How many hours in training do you have in this?
Well, you need about 680 hours.
Yeah,
if you
so just
have a
700.
Degree. So yeah, I have about 700 hours of psychodrama training.
Yeah, so that's a lot. So you were this close in the process to finishing that certification. So who better to talk about psychodrama with? And you and I have done a group together. It's your group, and you were generous enough to have me in there a good handful of times, co-facilitating that. So I'm looking forward to this, but we got to start at the beginning, kind of what is psychodrama? And I'm looking forward to your explanation of this because I get asked this a lot, and I feel like I feel like I need 30 minutes to explain what it is because it sounds kind of very different from what I imagine a lot of people think therapy is.
Yeah, so let me tell you a little bit about what psychodrama is. So psychodrama is a therapeutic treatment, and there are many different therapies, right? There's cognitive behavioral therapy, mm-hmm. there's psychodynamic therapies, and they're all, they have some similarities and some differences, but most of them involve just talking, right? You're going to come in and you're going to have a conversation. And psychodrama is more about doing and showing and not just talking. And so psychodrama helps us get out of our heads and into our bodies. So psychodrama is classified as an action technique. And so the main thing that we use is role playing and action in psychodrama. And so instead of just talking about a problem, we'll act it out, we'll role play it. So if someone comes in and they're saying, you know, I'm having a issue with my mom and she's making me really angry. Instead of just talking about it, I might say, let's get a chair. And what do you want to say to your mom?
I like that you describe it as an action technique and different, differentiating it from traditional talk therapy. You come in, what you might see in a lot of TV and stuff like that, you know, therapist sitting in one, you know, one chair, patient sitting in the other chair, and you're just talking about stuff. But psychodrama, you're moving around, you're really bringing a lot more into the room. And this stands for both individual and group, because not only do you do a group in it, but it also stands for you can do a lot of this in individual as well.
Absolutely. So the main modality that we'd use it in is group, but you can use it in individual therapy. And psychodrama techniques really help patients to identify and express feelings in a healthy way, increase their social skills and communication skills, helps with assertiveness, increasing self-esteem and confidence, and also most importantly is strengthening interpersonal relationships by helping them develop new skills and new sets and roles in their lives. It gives them a chance to practice things before doing them out in the world.
One thing I like about it that I think is interesting is that I think the two core tenets of any therapy are insight and then change. You know, the point is overall is we're looking to change something. I'm depressed. I don't want to be as depressed. I have poor boundary issues in my relationships. I don't want to have. I want to have better boundaries. That you're looking for, looking and understanding the dynamics of that, and then moving into to changing that. You know, that's the point of this. And I think psychodrama does a good bit of both. Of really increasing insight, but not just leaving it there, moving into really changing those dynamics in lots of fascinating and interesting ways. Would you agree with that assessment?
Absolutely. It's not just about developing insight, but it's about then how to put it into action. How do we actually use that insight to change our lives and to change our relationships?
So let's go even further back of a little of the history of this about where this came from, what I find fascinating is I bring this up to people and I feel like patients are like, I've never heard of this, but it's been around for 100+ years. So if you could give a little bit of the history of this, where it came from.
Okay, so before I give you a little bit of the history, let me just talk a little bit about the word psychodrama in and of itself, because people usually hear psychodrama and they think, oh, what is that? It sounds really scary. Yeah. We think of Alfred Hitchcock movies like Psycho and But actually, psychodrama comes from the Greek word psyche, which means soul. And so when you think about it that way, it actually is quite beautiful because it means it's the drama of one's soul. Mm-hmm. It's our story. It's our narrative. And we all live in a world where we have our stories and our stories need to be told. And so psychodrama allows us to put our stories on the stage. So we just don't talk about it, but we show them. And it's very, very powerful because what Moreno, and I'll talk about who Moreno was in just a minute, he's the founder of psychodrama, but Moreno realized that when we go to the theater, there's certain moments, certain elements where we connect and we might find ourselves crying at a specific scene or feeling along with that character, right? And we might say it's a catharsis.
Whether you're even aware of that or not. So mm-hmm. It might not be at face value that like, oh, I see this and that's a sad story because in this narrative, in this movie, their relationship ended or whatever. It might, the way you relate to it might be conscious or unconscious in what that's pulling up. There's a deeper part of you that is coming out. You were saying, I interrupted.
Absolutely. No, absolutely. So we're at this play and we find ourselves crying and we ask, why is that?
Sure.
Right. And it's because we're connected to something that we see on the stage, something that we are viewing is resonating with our own life. So we relate to it. And so he started playing around with this idea that we don't need to put fictional stories on the stage to relate to them, that we can put our own stories on the stage and that people will relate to our stories, that because we're humans, we all have similar experiences and we can connect with one another.
I'm trying to think because, like, two sort of phrases of psychodrama that I want to get to. We can do them now. We can talk about it later. When you talk about that, the drama of the soul, it makes me think of the idea of what I've heard you say, which is what I think you're paraphrasing from Moreno, is the idea of the heart has no eyes. That you're still – what comes up for me is that the work is always done on the inside for you. It doesn't have to actually be about that other person or whatever the dynamic is that you're working on. When you say that, that – drama of the soul, that's what comes up for me, what's going on in the inside. So I don't know if that, absolutely, and in
the context of a person's psychodrama, for example, and we'll talk more about this during the interview, but someone might be doing a drama and they have a person playing the role of their mom and they're doing a scene and they might have picked Jane, who's a member in the group, to come up and be their mom, and in that moment they are not talking to the group member, Jane. They are talking to their mom.
Sure.
And that's what that statement means, that the heart has no eyes. So the heart doesn't know that you're talking to Jane. Mm-hmm. Your heart thinks you're talking to your mother.
Yeah.
And the body knows no time. So anything that happens in that psychodrama moment is happening right now, but the body doesn't know the difference between now and before. We keep a lot of things trapped in the body. Trauma gets in the bodies. When people recall different trauma memories, they're feeling those body sensations because the body doesn't know time. And so any healing that happens, happens right now in the here and now.
So as you were going to do, backing up and talking about where did it come from with Moreno.
Right. So let me tell you a little bit about the history. And there's so many books that people can read and study. As I was studying for my written exam, I spent many, many hours reading about the rich history of Moreno. But to summarize a few key points. So Moreno lived around the time Freud lived. He was born in 1889 and he died in 1974. And it was Dr. Jacob Moreno. He was a psychiatrist from Vienna, so similar to Freud. And psychodrama didn't just happen. He didn't wake up one day and sort of discover psychodrama. Psychodrama was really a culmination of many different events in his life. Really going back to his training as a psychiatrist, but also in working with actors. He had sort of he called it the theater of spontaneity. And he worked with actors in being present in the moment and putting on spontaneous shows. So instead of something that's rehearsed, but just creating it right then and there for audiences. He was actually sort of the founder of many things. People credit him with improv, with group therapy, which we'll talk about in a little bit, as well as psychodrama and a host of other things. So he came to the States in 1925. He opened up a psychiatric hospital in 1936 called Beacon Psychiatric Hospital, and this is where he built his famous psychodrama stage. And he started working with patients who weren't getting cured in other places. And this was his own psychiatric hospital, so he had a lot of freedom to do things in the way that he wanted to do them. Even back then, there was sort of stress from administration and things like that, sort of saying how to do treatment. And so he opened up his own hospital, and he...
Which one does. When you're frustrated with things, you open up
right.
a hospital.
And he started helping patients that other people couldn't help, and they started seeing change. And he did it through utilizing this method of psychodrama. And what's really exciting is that the original Moreno psychodrama stage still exists. It's been moved to Boughton Place, which is... a theater space, and also it hosts many different training programs in upstate New York. And mm-hmm. so I've had the privilege of doing psychodramas on that stage through the Hudson Valley Psychodrama Institute in New York. So let me actually go back to how Moreno discovered group therapy, because that's one of his very important contributions. And that happened before psychodrama. But on the way, as I was talking about earlier, there are many different things that led up to what we know as psychodrama. So back in 1913, he was working as a psychiatrist in Vienna, and he started meeting with a group of prostitutes. And at that time, this is really important because prostitutes were labeled as sinners and unworthy people. They were considered lower than a criminal. Okay.
Has that really changed much, even in like modern day America? But that's an aside. We'll leave that. The treatment of sex workers will be maybe a different episode.
And so he started meeting with these women who really began to trust him. And again, you can understand how difficult it would be to trust that this man would be wanting to help them. And so he started meeting with these groups of women several times a week, and he would bring a snack, and they talked about the different problems that arose. And so they talked about getting arrested and possibly getting pregnant, and they got checked for diseases and just the stressors of what they were doing. And they ended up being able to get legal help and medical help. But what was really important for him is he began to see that it wasn't him that was really important. It was that the women were helping each other. They were acting, as Moreno says, as therapeutic agents of the other. And so they were the ones creating the change, right? So getting a group of people together that have similar challenges is really beneficial. And so that was group therapy. He ended up doing group therapy as we know it. He later coined the term group psychotherapy in 1932. But that was really the beginning. And it just happened in the serendipitous way. He didn't necessarily plan to go out and do it. It's what was created in the moment, in the now. And so there's that piece of it with the group psychotherapy. He then moved to the United States, started doing research, looking at relationships between girls living in a group home, working in hospitals. He then opened up his own psychiatric hospital, and that's where the psychodrama stage was. So all of this stuff is happening, which then sort of, again, leads to what we know today as psychodrama. So let me say a little bit more about some of the other things that we might know, we might have heard of, people who, you know, sometimes even pop psychology, who might be watching a show on television, they go, oh, that looks familiar. Mm-hmm. A lot of people, when they think of psychodrama, they might think of the empty chair technique.
Sure.
Right? Where you might take the empty chair and you might say, in this chair sits your mom. What do you want to say to your mom? Or in this chair is your anger. And that's the empty chair technique. And a lot of people think Fritz Perls came up with that. Fritz Perls was a psychologist that did Gestalt psychology. But actually, Fritz Perls had learned from Moreno. And so Moreno actually originally came up with that. So that's something that people might resonate with and say, oh, I know that. Sort of, I've seen that.
Yeah, I think that's the most common example is the empty chair, because I think, like most things in therapy, have been bastardized in entertainment. And the idea of your mom's in that chair, yell at mom and stuff like that, which isn't at all... is really a caricature of what that work really can be, which comes up when I'm introducing psychodrama with folks and I do empty chair. They have the face like, this is really what we're doing, and think it's like a hokey thing until you're really into it. So that's a lot of the origin story. That's a lot of the origin story of Moreno. And for some reason, I have a mental block on his first name. Was, you already said it, and I've already forgotten it.
Jacob.
I always think, I always want to call him Salvador, and I think it's just that's being confused with Mnuchin, who, if you're listening, we actually talked about in the last episode with Dr. Michael Eisenberg, related to family therapy. But the name is not important. So that is a lot of the origin of that, of, you know, him going to plays and him creating this stage and looking at, what I read is a lot of our interactions with other people, and I don't know to what extent you can talk about how that led to role theory, and role theory and that idea relates to psychodrama.
So psychodrama is also based in role theory, and this idea that life is a bunch of different roles, right? Mm-hmm. So each person, we play sometimes maybe, you know, 50 different roles, you know, where a mom, a daughter, a sister, a teacher, a student, a supervisee, a supervisor. There's many different roles that we play. And sometimes we get very stuck in a specific role, and it's hard for us to try on a new role. And we don't know how to sort of move forward with that. We don't know how to take a new role. We don't know how to create a future role. And we get stuck in certain roles in our own lives. You know, husbands and wives get stuck in certain roles. And when there's no room for growth, no room to expand the roles, we can get role fatigue. Mm-hmm. And it can make it really difficult in our interpersonal relationships.
Well, when I think about that, I think about the idea of reacting versus responding. I did not come up with that. That was from another psychodramatist we know from John Raspberry down in Tupelo, Mississippi, Mid-South Center for Psychodrama, if you're interested to Google him and you're in the South. But John talked about this idea of reacting versus responding. That comes up for me because thinking when you're stuck in that role, you're reacting. It's just your kind of pat response. You're not having, you know, you're stuck in kind of a one-dimensional. This is what I'm stuck in. A role I think of is the person who is stoic, the person who is always the protector of others. They are not in the role of being somebody who's vulnerable. So when stuff comes up in their life, they're the one who, I got everything together and I'm going to be in that role. And they're just reacting because it becomes this set response versus responding, which is more of a spontaneous, authentic, genuine response, for lack of a better, to what actually is going on. So maybe you're in the stoic position. Maybe you're in the showing more vulnerability. Does that make sense?
No, absolutely. And what you're talking about is really being able to role create, right? If we're creating a role, we have a high degree of freedom in it. And that's when we can take a role that we've had and expand upon it, figure out a new way to do it, or create an entirely different role. And that requires a level of spontaneity, which is another really important thing that Moreno talked about. And that's mm-hmm. important in psychodrama, is that in order to create, we have to be spontaneous. And in order to survive, really, we have to be spontaneous, coming up with new solutions to problems. The definition of spontaneity is creating an adequate response to a new situation or an adequate and novel response to an old situation. And that's what allows us to move forward. And so we also talk about how we have to change the role that we're playing in order to change our life and ourself, right? If we change the role, we can change the self, because the self is made up of many different roles.
Yeah. So this gets into a lot of stuff, and I'm glad we're fleshing out a lot of this, the basic ideas and principles about what psychodrama is, about the roles we're in, about spontaneity, and also another piece to spontaneity about you can't really be authentically responding if you're super anxious. So the idea of that kind of seesaw, that the higher anxiety goes, the less spontaneous you're going to be. The less your anxiety is, or as it decreases, your spontaneity can go up. So people can get locked in that with, you know, the same dynamic with their partner, for example, or the same dynamic with their parent or one of their parents, where, you know, they just get into it. Somebody gets defensive. They say things they don't mean or they regret later. Your anxiety's up in that moment. You're feeling defensive, so you protect yourself. I wonder if you would categorize it that one of the things psychodrama can do in that scenario is help the person work on getting the anxiety to go down and to be more spontaneous, to be more authentically responding, so you don't play out the same patterns in your life over and over and over again.
Yeah, absolutely. And that was really Moreno's goal with psychodrama, was to help people live more fully, live life in the most spontaneous way possible. And so you're absolutely right with anxiety. People who are anxious have very low spontaneity in that moment when they're feeling high anxiety. And so psychodrama is great for reducing symptoms of anxiety because it helps patients to get in touch more with their spontaneity.
So I don't know how much more you want to talk about important historical points about where psychodrama came from. I'm actually curious to know, I don't know if you know, have this answer. I know that it sort of had a resurgent in, I think it was like the 60s and 70s, where I think that came up in a lot of the group work. And then, you know, why is it that we don't hear as much about it? Because, again, I talk about it with people frequently in, you know, professionally with patients and personally in my life with people around me. And they're just like, they'd never heard of it.
So I think one of the reasons we don't hear as much about psychodrama is that in graduate schools, they're not really teaching psychodrama. And that's really unfortunate. So I went through my entire graduate experience not ever hearing the word psychodrama, and I discovered it during my internship year. Mm-hmm. And for a lot of students, that's true. I think with cognitive behavioral therapy that had come aboard and need for evidence-based treatments and what's getting researched sort of came to the forefront, and people started saying, this is what we're going to do, this is what the science says, this is what the research says. And psychodrama, there's some research for psychodrama, and we're trying to get more research for psychodrama. Yet it's difficult with some of these expressive therapy forms to really study that in the same way that we can study CBT, for example.
Sure.
And so because there isn't as much research, and because people aren't teaching it, it begins to sort of fade away while these new therapies come aboard. Thankfully, I think it's becoming more prominent now. I think the younger generation is getting excited about it. I know I'm really excited about it.
Yeah.
I'm trying to spread the word about psychodrama. I think other younger clinicians are saying, oh my gosh, what is this? I didn't learn about this either. And they're getting on board and they're beginning to train. I think another thing that's difficult for psychodrama is that it does require a lot of training. It's a very specialized therapeutic technique that you can't just go to one training and call yourself a psychodramatist and start doing psychodrama. There are certain pieces of the psychodrama that you can start doing with patients, but you can't just go out and do it. And so I think that sometimes might deter people, especially after they're getting a master's degree or a doctorate degree, and then to find out, you know, okay, it's going to be 5 more years of study to learn this. But it's so powerful and so worth it.
Yeah, and I agree with you about the piece about it not getting taught. When I was finishing grad school, I had one, I can't really say lecture because it was a group therapy class, and it was all experiential. So there was like 10-minute lecture, and then we were running groups and, you know, practicing it and doing feedback and stuff. There was one time in one class where that group therapist had been trained in it, brought that up and showed us that, but it was not fully explained because it was shown sort of in action, kind of that, some empty chair doing that. And when we were doing the exercise, it like brought stuff up for me, and I think that distracted me from like realizing or recognizing what actually was going on, and I was more kind of thinking about that. And it wasn't until a couple years later where we met, where you had been, you know, training in it for a while, and that's where I saw it more. I started going to trainings and seeing it with patients. And part of the thing about the training, the idea that you have 700 hours isn't that you've just been sitting around reading books. Like we as the trainees have to do that work, have to go through the psychodramatic work. So which is also another, I think, impediment to some people wanting to do it. And I found that going through it, I could feel different and notice changes in my life from my own experience. And I think that's where people get hooked on it, is seeing those changes so fast, so quickly. And it definitely like opened my eyes and like seeing where at different times, like, wow, we can get to this thing so much faster and at so much greater depth and really create a lot of healing. I agree with you. I think and also the research, we have moved into a, you know, evidence-based and, you know, and the criteria is so strict that it doesn't lend itself to everything. And psychodrama, I'm not a researcher. You're more of a researcher than I am. It's sort of hard how would you quantify that? How would you, do that in like a randomly controlled, was it trial? Is that what the T stands for in RCT? Yeah, I almost said therapy. That's not what that is. In an RCT where things are so stringent in the criteria, it really doesn't lend itself. So then there's not enough research. So then the people doing it are saying, well, we can't do that because there's no research behind it. So it's unfortunate that for now, although, as you said, there's more research being done. So hopefully that will change.
Absolutely. I think if we can do more research and really show psychodrama's effectiveness, it will get us in the limelight again, and people will pay more attention to it, and they won't say, oh, well, what's that? Or that's a blast from the past. Or, I'm happy doing my CBT. You also touched on another important point, which you said, I think maybe some people got deterred because they have to go through it themselves because it's experiential. And
Sure. That's
very true. I mean, we like to hope in our field that everyone who's a practicing psychologist has done their own work. But sometimes that's not the case. And so especially when it's so experiential and in the moment and can bring things up, it can be really frightening. And people can say, oh, that's not for me. I don't want to be vulnerable.
Yeah.
And it can make it really challenging. But if you can challenge yourself, right, and lower your anxiety a little bit and warm up to the idea of trying something new, it can be really magical.
Yeah, absolutely. So let's see. Where should we go from here? We've talked a bit about the history. I don't know if you want to add more about that. I want to talk about, get into some examples and talk about, what it actually looks like in the room.
Actually, I just wanted to say one other thing. We were talking about role earlier, and one of the healing elements of psychodrama happens in the role reversal. So when you're stepping into the shoes of another person and mm-hmm. you're getting a new perspective, learning happens in that moment because you're seeing the situation from the other side. And so that's just an important thing to recognize, too, that happens in a psychodrama.
I'm really glad you brought that up because that was one of the questions that I had, is the idea of, let's say you have two women who are in a relationship, and you have John and Jane Doe, or not John, excuse me, Jane and Ashley Doe. And Jane is the one who's in the doing the psychodrama work. And she says, oh, I have some trouble with my partner. And, I want to explore that. I want to work that out. How do you think that, by going over, let's say, a typical argument, so you set up that scene and you have a typical argument between Jane and Ashley Doe, that how is it that when Jane is in the role of Ashley Doe, that she gets so much more more from that or that new perception?
Because she's stepping outside of herself, right? So oftentimes when we're in relationships, it's easy to get stuck in our own role, and especially if we're angry or upset, and not see past what's happening with us. And so in psychodrama, the protagonist, the person that's doing the drama, the main character, is actually in all the roles. And so even though they may pick, again, Jane to step in as the mom or the partner.
Or even an empty chair.
Yeah. They're still going to reverse roles, as we call it, where they're going to become their mom or become their partner. And they're going to give the dialogue to the person that's playing that role.
Yeah.
So they have to step into the role and respond as if they were that person. So if she's stepping into her partner's role, she might, if we warm her up in a good way, she'll be able to see things from the partner's perspective. Moreno said that healing happens in that role reversal. And he actually has a really good quote that I'll read that describes sort of what role reversal is. He says, it's a meeting of two, eye to eye, face to face. And when you are near, I will tear your eyes out and place them instead of mine. And you will tear my eyes out and will place them instead of yours. Then I will look at you with your eyes and you will look at me with mine.
He must have liked the theater. That's very vivid. It brings up King Lear in my mind, where one of the main characters has his eyes ripped out. Wow, how evocative of a quote. So, but yes, that does give back to the idea that gives that perspective of being able to see yourself from a different angle, being able to get out of that kind of stilted pattern that you're in with that partner, with mom, with dad, mm-hmm. with brother, whoever it is. So yeah, that's certainly vivid.
Right. So it allows us to leave ourselves and become the other for a moment.
Sure.
Right. And so it helps us then understand where the person's coming from.
Sure.
And that can be really, really healing.
So let's, if we can, because I think it'd be the most helpful way to go through it, is talk about an example of, I want to start with individual therapy and then I want to go to group. So I want to talk about literally running it through of an individual therapy, how that would look like to give sense. Because then we've been talking about it's an action technique, reverse roles, we're using kind of these terms. So I want to break it down. We'll just come up with an example and think about what that looks like. So let's say you have a guy come in and it's for individual therapy. And let's say he's been working on he comes in being anxious, anxious about, let's say he's in his 40s. I suppose it doesn't matter. But guy in his 40s, he's anxious, and he's anxious about if his partner is going to stay with him, you know, and, you know, I don't know, am I good enough? Do I look good enough? Whatever. And that's how he comes in. Where would you go from there? You know, the main issue is I'm having all this anxiety. I have a lot of anxiety in my relationship, specifically with my partner. I'm worried about, if I'm good enough for them or if I'm, I don't know. If I'm a good enough partner for them, I'm worried about them leaving me. I'm not enough, et cetera, et cetera. Let's say they come in with that.
Yeah, so I might want them to have a discussion with their partner, right? But their partner is not here. So we'll put them in the role of their partner. So I'd have them get an empty chair and I'd have them become their partner. I'd say, okay, I want you to sit like your partner, hold their body position. And then I would interview them in the role of their partner.
So pausing for a second. So they're sitting across from you and you say to them, you know, get a chair for your partner. And then they grab another chair and say, okay, in this chair, and you say, be that partner. So then they get up from the chair that they've been in and move to that other chair to be this other role, as you were saying.
Yes. And so then I'll interview them in the role of the partner. We call that the warm-up, because we can't just expect someone to sort of sit down and take on someone else's role. They're still themselves.
Sure.
And so we have to warm them up. And so I'll ask them interview questions, and sometimes I'll ask them, you know, tell me what color shoes you're wearing. And so they'll look down, and I hope that they'll tell me not the shoe color that's on their foot, but what they would think their partner would be wearing, and
sure,
what their outfit looks like, and a little bit about themselves, and maybe their hobbies, their interests, what the relationship is like. And so they'll be telling me this in the role of the partner.
Yeah.
And then I'll let the partner know that their partner, did we give him a name?
No, we didn't give anybody a name. So
let's call him John.
Yes, yeah, so John's your patient.
That John wanted to talk to him about a couple of things today. And then I'll reverse roles, meaning that John will leave the role of his partner and come back in the chair and be himself. And then he'll open it up and he'll start talking to his partner. And we'll reverse roles a couple of times where then maybe John says, you know, I'm really worried about where a relationship is going. And then I'll say, okay, reverse roles. So John will then move back to the chair and become his partner again. And he'll then say a couple of things from the partner's perspective.
Sure.
And he might say, I don't know why you're so worried. I'm not worried. Okay?
Yeah.
Reverse roles. And then he'll come back and sit down again. And I'll tell John, so hear your partner saying, I'm not worried. Go ahead and respond to that. And so we'll go back and forth like this in the discussion. And while this is happening, I'm also thinking about, is there anything that's not getting expressed? Is there anything that he's holding inside? And we all do this. We all have things that we don't say, right, that we keep close to our heart. And so then what I'll do is a technique called doubling, where I'll say to him, so John, I'm going to say something as you. Mm-hmm. And I want you to state it if it's true, or correct it if it's wrong. Make it your truth. And so I might pick up on something that John's holding back, and I might then make this doubling statement.
Mm-hmm.
And so that could be, you know, when you leave and go out with your friends, I feel abandoned.
Mm-hmm. And then his response to that might be, if he agrees, oh, you know, yeah, I agree. When you leave with your friends, I feel abandoned. Or he might correct it and say, know when you leave and go out with your friends, or it's not an issue about the you leaving and going out with your friends. It's that, you know, you don't acknowledge the things I do around the house, whatever. But they have that. I think that's an important piece here. They have, they always have that flexibility there to, you know, because we've never met these people. We, you know, the patient, but we've never met the partners, the moms, the deceased, you know, whoever, their anxiety, whatever we're bringing into the room. So I think that's a really important piece that I think that it's so empowering for people to say, no, that's not what they would say, or that's not, I don't think that's true. I don't think I'm angry. I think that I am frustrated. Even just that little correction, I think, is really powerful for people. So they would either – so you double. You kind of search and you have a hunch about what maybe there's some other stuff not being said. And then you would bring that out. Are you familiar with the comedian Jim Gaffigan?
No.
Okay. Well, I'm going to have to send you some stuff.
Okay. I'll have to look him up.
Yeah. So Jim Gaffigan, hilarious. He's, you know, a top-selling comedian, written several books, very successful, very, very funny man. Gaffigan actually, I and this is funny because I'm actually telling you this. I have forgotten to tell you this many, many times. But Gaffigan actually uses doubling in his act. And it's just, it's not said that way. It's not like, this is doubling. But if you, especially for those who are listening who know Jim Gaffigan and know his stand-up, one of his hallmark pieces is doubling the audience. So he'll say a joke and he'll be saying, you know, like, oh yeah, my, you know, my wife was doing this. And then, and you know, I just wanted to ignore her, you know, and eat a sandwich. And then he'll use another voice to double the audience. So he'll be like, as the audience, like, man, that guy talks about food a lot. So it's a funny example in like your everyday life or whatever, where that idea that is this that we use in a clinical sense is just there. And again, if you know Jim Gaffigan, go back, watch his routines. Like, that is a great example of doubling what the audience is going through. And he'll joke about he's talking too much about something, or he went too far with a joke. A question I have is if you can speak to the idea of pulling out, not bringing in the room, not just people, but also anxiety, guilt, insecurity, all that. If you can, in this same example, talk about any example of that.
Yeah. So we might also bring in his anxiety. So it might be that when he's talking to his partner, he then shuts down because anxiety has gone up and he's sort of frozen in the anxiety.
Sure.
And so in talk therapy, I mean, you could talk about it. Well, this is psychodrama, so I would say get a chair for the anxiety. And then he would reverse roles with his anxiety. And that's the cool thing about psychodrama is we can reverse roles with anything. We can become anything. So we can have a conversation with our anxiety, with our anger, with our fear. It doesn't matter. We can put it in a role. And so he can talk to his anxiety. And when do we get to do that? And so he'd talk to his anxiety and find out about that relationship. Where did it start? How long has it been there?
When the
does
anxiety.
It? Yeah. When yeah, does yeah. it show up? You know, showing up now. What does the anxiety need to give him some space to have this discussion with his partner?
So they get to be, and again, in this example, their anxiety. And you might go really explore that. There might be something there. You know, the idea that, you know, like the baggage that people bring in, you know, that there's really another issue going on. It's less about between John and his partner. It's about a dynamic that has played out in his relationship. So you might, depending on what happens in that scene, because we never really know what's going to come up. That's been my experience in working with folks. You know, you have a hunch where things are going to go. And then suddenly we're talking about, you know, Uncle Sam, you know, not like America, Uncle Sam, but let's say they had we'll say Uncle Samuel. Which is also really wonderful about, you never know where it's going to go. So they might be that anxiety thing, and they might, as John, as his anxiety might say, oh, well, I've been with John since age 5, because that's what John's dad taught him. You might then go backwards and explore that a little further. If you could talk about that.
Yeah, so the great thing about psychodrama is that it allows us to examine our interpersonal relationships in the present. it also allows us to go back and look at where we learned things from in our past, and also lets us rehearse for the future and actually imagine the future. So you can sort of time travel as well in psychodrama. And we know that when things happen in our past, it can affect us today. And again, this idea that the body knows no time. And so things get stuck, and we get stuck in these roles, right? We learned to act in a certain way based on learning that happened when we were young. And if we don't have other interactions where we can change that, we haven't tried on new roles, if we haven't felt comfortable, we get stuck in these old roles that are uncomfortable. And so, yeah, so we learn that anxiety happened and showed up on the scene when he's five. We can go back then and we can say, take us to a time when anxiety came when you were five.
Yeah.
And then we can see what happened then. It might have been that he was five and he got bullied at school, and he might show us a classroom scene where there was a bully who picked on him and there was nobody there to protect him. And his anxiety might have said, shh, don't say anything.
And this, again, I want to be clear about the language that you're using, is that this is to be shown. This is not to be told. So it's not, there's not going to be a pause in this interaction where he says, oh, well, yeah, you know, this goes back to fourth grade. And in fourth grade, there was this bully and they said this. You would say, show, don't tell.
Right. Show, don't tell. And the idea is that everything's happening in the here and now. So we're going to see this scene. Yes, we're going back to the past. But we're actually replaying it right now in the present. So it's sort of happening again so we can examine it.
Yeah, to really, really explore it. So again, you have this is one, again, in this example, John comes in, he's talking about his anxiety, it's about relationships and stuff like that. So it might be really exploring the dynamics with a partner. You're using doubling to kind of see that, to look at what, you know, where's the real juice of things about what's going on in that. And that might lead you backwards, or that might lead you to more interaction with the anxiety and how that impacts his life. You might even start with the anxiety. So you might say, before we even meet the partner, let's talk with your anxiety. Let's explore that. Mm-hmm. What do you hope is that John's supposed to get, you know, from that? So you see him for 50 minutes and that's, he comes in ready to, this is what's going on. You start exploring that. I suppose the question is what's the point of that? How would you describe, like, why would you even be doing that in the first place?
Well, every time you do it, you have to have a goal, and the goal is driven from the protagonist. We call it the contract. So they set a contract about what they want to get out of that psychodrama session. So for him, it might be, I want to be able to express a couple of things to my partner, or I want to turn down the volume of my anxiety. And so that's what we're going. We always have to keep that in mind, what the goal is.
Yeah, right? Which, because, is not our goal. It's not the therapist's goal.
Right, right. Yeah. It's the patient's goal. And we have to be mindful that as we are going down the psychodrama path, just like we would have to be mindful of that in talk therapy. You know, if a patient comes in and they say, I need to talk about my mom, and then they spend 45 minutes talking about their dog, that's not helping us get to their mom.
Sure.
So let me tell you about this idea of surplus reality, because this is one of the special properties of psychodrama, is that we can do things outside of sort of everyday reality, meaning that we can look at realities that we haven't even experienced. We can do things that we can't do day to day. So, for example, I've had patients who have talked to their MS, who have talked to relatives, who have died, and we can bring them back into the room. We can also have conversations with people anywhere we want. So you don't have to have a conversation with your mom in the living room in your house. You could have the conversation in a coffee shop or on a cloud or at the beach. Sure. So you can really have it wherever you want. And you can talk to people and experience things that you never thought imaginable. So we even go to the future sometimes. You could have a talk with your unborn child. You could see your children and your grandchildren. And it's not just pretending, because it feels so real. Again, the heart has no eyes and the body knows no time. And so you can practice for the future and you can have these wonderful experiences.
Absolutely. And there's also, you might talk to God, you might talk to, you know, Jesus or whatever deity you want to talk to. You might even bring Superman in for added support if you have to challenge somebody who's really difficult to voice, you know, to add that added, you know, support. In the example, we'll go back to the example in a minute. The one other thing I want to talk about, the surplus reality, is that I suppose there's this weird, like, you have to experience it to really know what psychodrama is like. So if you're even 1/16th kind of like, that sounds interesting, I really do encourage you to use the internet, find somebody who does psychodrama near you. There are definitely people around the country. There are a lot of people available to check it out, because it really is to experience it. Because I think intellectually, I fully understood. I had a decent grasp of like what it was doing or whatever, but to go through it and to have that surplus reality happened to me, where I was in the middle of a dialogue with someone and it really felt like everybody had left the room. And this was in a group context, so there was probably another 10 people in that room. And it wasn't like, oh, I cooled down, I stopped thinking about it, I stopped being subconscious. I was absolutely talking to the person that I was talking to. And it was really, really eye-opening to have that experience. So I really do encourage people, if you're even 1/16th interested in this, to really try it out, because it sort of sounds kind of like, what are you going to be doing? I'm talking to an empty chair? What? You know, to my dead great grandma, that doesn't make any sense. But it really, you really got to experience it, because it is an experiential and active therapy. I want to go back to the individual example. One other thing before we move to group, which is really like the big show when it comes to psychodrama, as you said, that's where it originated. So in the example of John is having this dialogue with the partner, and they're getting into it and they're doing that thing. Maybe there's a dynamic there where John really can't say those things. He goes into anxiety, and the anxiety is still there even when you pull that out. Okay, let's get a chair for anxiety. It's still there. A big piece to a lot of psychodrama that I really got from you is the sense of safety and support. So this is an example. I'm reluctant to say benign comparative to other things. So this might be, you know, someone having a dialogue with their abuser, or you know, it might be, you know, someone who had raped them, or it might not even be that severe. It might be, you know, confronting mom who was critical their whole life. Not to say that that's not severe, but you know, it's very different. And a person might, as you said, freeze and lock up. So if you can speak a little to the sense of safety that you create in that, where you see somebody, they might come in, they're like, again, modifying this example, John comes in, he's like, oh man, I got stuff. And you know, my mom always did this and she was super critical. And I want to tell her what's what, like they're ready to go. And then you bring mom in the room, quote unquote, and John locks up. Kind of how you would address that in a safety context.
Right. So safety is so critical when you're doing psychodrama, and that's why training is so important, especially Absolutely. When right, especially when we're dealing with anyone who's had a trauma history, which is many of the patients that we see. So we want to make sure that we have a very, very safe environment. And so whether it is talking to a mom who was really critical and scary, or whether it was a trauma where there had been some kind of physical abuse or sexual abuse, we create safety in the room before the person talks and expresses their feelings to that person. And there's many different ways, again, in psychodrama to do that. So I've had patients who want, you know, an entire army set up between them and the perpetrator. And again, it might be the empty chair in your office or in a group setting. It's someone playing that role, holding that role. So we enroll an army. They might want a mom in jail in a prison cell locked up, and we create that in the room. Okay, here's the prison cell. And how far do you want to be away from the prison cell? And what else do you need? I need, you know, two lions outside. So if she happened to get out of it, they'll be there. Or I want her in a tower, you know, 1,000 feet in the sky, where she can't get out at all. And there's an army around it, and it's in the middle of a lake. So whatever they want, again, that's sort of that surplus reality. They can create it for safety. And so in doing that and in creating the safety, it allows their anxiety to go down and their spontaneity to go up. And they then feel safe enough to begin to express the things that they never got to express and to confront them about the abuse or the trauma that they had subjected them to.
yeah, whatever the contract was, because the contract might have been, I just want to say the things I never got to say.
Right.
I want them to hear me. Or the contract is, I want to be able to say out loud to them, you abuse me, whatever. And I also want to bring this up again, the idea of safety, that when I've talked to, you know, friends and people I know about it, it feels like a lot, like I'm just going to bring that person in, even with that sense of safety. I also want to highlight that, again, this idea of warming up. You have to warm up to be open and spontaneous enough to be able to do whatever the work you're planning on doing. You don't want to be crushed by anxiety, or repeated dynamic. So it might be 6, 7, 8, 10 sessions warming up to bring mom in the room or perpetrator. So it's not just like, well, we're on day one and, you know, I was sexually abused and that was a really big thing. Well, you know, sexual abuser, come on down. Like, you're not going to start there. You would have a lot of work there because they might say, I'm worried about what my reaction is going to be. I'm going to get angry. I'm going to cry a lot. And then the session might be, well, let's meet that worry. Let's meet those tears, et cetera. To no matter how long it takes to establish that sense of safety to get to whatever the contract they're trying to do.
Absolutely. So whatever that might be, we can facilitate it. You know, sometimes it's talking to their younger self, you know, what we call sort of the inner child, that we all have an inner child that we carry around with us. And oftentimes when we've experienced something traumatic, it was when we were younger. And so it's that little part of ourselves that got really injured. But again, the body knows no time and that part travels with us. And so sometimes it's just having them have a conversation with that six-year-old that got traumatized. And that can be really powerful and create safety.
Yeah, absolutely. So that's a little stuff about individual and empty chair work and safety. Now let's move to the big show, group psychotherapy, where you might do some empty chair work to warm people up. But then in back to the example of John, you would have an actual person there. So, you know, John picks someone to be your partner, or John picks someone to be this abuser, or John picks somebody to be your anxiety. If you can speak about, to me, it's very different in a group context, even in that example or another example, kind of what that looks like.
Yeah, so the group context was really how Moreno developed it. It was a group psychotherapy. And it's really very, very powerful in a group because you have people actually in those auxiliary roles and they are saying back the dialogue. If their spontaneity goes up, the auxiliaries might create a little bit of the role themselves and add to the role. And so it's a different experience. It's more powerful from my own experience, and I think from many of my patients' experience, to do it in a group setting.
Sure. So then in a group context, you're going to start out with some, let's say there's 10 people there, right? And it's going to be a mixed group, an adult group. You're not going to have like a 7-year-old in there. So you have an adult group, for example. You have about 10 people in there, you know, different racial backgrounds, different cultural backgrounds, male, female, transgender, it doesn't matter. Whoever's in there, no limits on age again, except for maybe like 18 or 19 and above. And there's no cap. There's no like, well, you're 80, you waited too long. Sorry. Be whoever, right? So you have this group of 10 people, and then you might start to do some warm-up exercises looking at themes, you know, what's coming up. You don't just start the group like, right, who wants to talk? What are we doing here? You'd have some warm-up exercises, people interacting with each other. If you can talk a little bit about that piece, about some of the warming up and why do that in the first place.
So yes, there's three parts to a psychodrama. So there's the warm-up, there's the action, and then there's the sharing. Mm-hmm. So that's what you'll see in a typical psychodrama group. So you can't jump into the action without a proper warm-up because people's spontaneity will be very low and anxiety will be high and no one will step forward and want to work on anything. So what you do is you warm the group up, and there's different ways of doing that. So maybe the theme for the day is anxiety. So you could do one exercise, you could do several exercises, but maybe you might have an empty chair in the room and you might say, this is your anxiety, place yourself in proximity to the chair, which will demonstrate how close you feel your anxiety is to you. on a daily basis.
Sure. So then you have a chair in the center, and then, you know, would you use all of them at the same time, or would you wait one by one? Or I guess it doesn't matter.
There's all different ways to do it. So you could do it though as a group, and you could say, okay, so I want you to place yourself in relationship to the chair to demonstrate where your anxiety is in relation to you in your day-to-day life, or you could say in this moment.
Sure.
And then they would move in relation to the chair, and then each person would begin to share, I stand here because. So you might have somebody that's really far away from the chair, and they might say, I'm not feeling anxious at all. My anxiety only comes like once a year, and so, you know, I'm on the other side of the room. And you might have someone else that is practically sitting in the chair, and they're like, I'm so anxious. I'm anxious all the time. I'm anxious right now, and my anxiety is here 24/7. I never can get away from it. And so that's a nice way in action. Again, we're not sitting in a circle talking about how anxious we are. Mm-hmm. We're actually showing it. And there's a power in moving to the spot, feeling it in your body, and then owning that with the group. Okay. So even that, you're beginning to warm up. You're beginning to get comfortable with the movement and the action part of it. And then from that, maybe you would go into, okay, so now what's one message that you have for your anxiety? And you might have each person share a message to the empty chair. So they're getting a little bit hotter, ready to go, to be able to look at this more in depth. And you might do a couple of these activities. And then what I like to do is get my magic scarf, but there's many different ways to do this. So I have a scarf and I put
This is an actual scarf. This is not a psychodramatic, like imagine a scarf. You have a whole box full of these very colorful, beautiful scarves.
Yes.
You have like a dozen and change.
Yes. Psychodramatists, for whatever reason, love scarves. I learned that from my supervisors, Judy and Rebecca, who work at Hudson Valley, and I've just adopted that, and I've gotten a lot of scarves too. So I have an actual scarf that I use though as sort of my magic scarf, and I place that in the center of the room, and then the group comes around the scarf, and I'll say, so if you put your foot in on the scarf, that represents that you want to look at this further. You want to explore your anxiety further. And so I'll have them in that moment, too, to see what is it like to put their foot on the scarf? What is it like to pull their foot back so they can feel in their body? What is it like to take that step into putting myself forward? Even that is really vulnerable, right? Just to step on the scarf, to put yourself forward and say, there's something I might want to work on, is really scary. And for some people, that might be all they do, but that's been a big step.
Sure, absolutely.
Just to name it. Just to move.
I think also, sorry to interrupt, but I think also for some people to, in that moment, there's a lot there. Again, some of the stuff like seems like, how is this working? But it does. It really is powerful. A lot of that body movement to move from chair to chair, to move around, to walk around, to see, you know, to gain the new perspective, but physically do that. To put your foot down on there and be there is also advocating for yourself, you know? So even that, whether they do a whole drama, whether they get picked or whether that's what happened, or they're like, that's cool. That is just that, just standing or just really advocating for yourself and allowing yourself to be that vulnerable is so profound, which is another thing that I want to kind of pause on what we're talking about to talk about a larger idea that it all is helpful. So even just like, oh, we only did 2 minutes because something came up at the very end about you talking about young you, because that's the timing of the session or whatever. But even that is powerful. Even trying to select yourself for a protagonist where you're putting your foot down, that is helpful. It's not just like, well, you have to do a full drama and you got to be the protagonist and you got to go back to childhood. That there isn't a narrow, that's the only thing that helps. It's all very helpful.
Absolutely. And it all will get processed even after that psychodrama session is over.
Sure.
So all the research now looking at neuropsychology and all of that in the brain lets us know that processing happens even after the session is over.
Yeah.
And so healing happens on many different levels. And so, right. So for that person who has difficulty speaking up, just owning that, okay, this is what I would do my drama about. And sometimes I've had patients say, I would want to do my drama on this, but I don't want to do it right now, but I just want to name it.
Sure. Absolutely.
And that's great.
Yeah.
So going back to that example, I have them put their foot in, I have them take it out, and then I'll say, okay, everyone put your foot on the scarf. and leave it on the scarf unless you know that you definitely do not want to work today. And so usually then, if you've adequately warmed up the group, you'll have a couple of people. If you've really warmed up the group, you might have all of them saying, okay, there's something I want to work on. And so then the people that have identified themselves as wanting to work on something, they will then share a sentence or two about what their drama would be about. So again, the group example we're using had a theme about anxiety.
Yeah.
One person might say, I want to look at the anxiety I feel in the workplace. Someone else might want to say, I want to look at how my anxiety freezes me when I go on dates. Someone else might say, I want to look at the anxiety between me and my mom. It's really impacting our relationship. And so then what happens is once they've identified what they want to work on, the group actually makes a selection of which psychodrama they're going to witness today. Mm-hmm. And this is important because they're not choosing the person, but they're choosing the theme that most resonates with themselves. And mm-hmm. it's a selfish choice that each person has to make. And sometimes it can be really difficult mm-hmm. because you can only choose one person
yeah.
and one theme.
Yeah.
And so they will put their hand on the shoulder of the person whose psychodrama most resonates with them. And then everyone will share with the person that they chose. You know, I chose you because I also need to work on the anxiety I feel when I'm talking to my mom, or every time I have a conversation with my boss, it makes me so anxious. And there'll be one person at the end of that who will be the protagonist.
Mm-hmm.
So one person who's chosen then to go and put their full story on the stage. So that's how we warm the group up.
Yeah.
And then how we choose someone for the action. Now, I want to say just a little bit about the healing aspect of this. So in a group, I said before, healing happens on all levels. So it doesn't matter whether you are the protagonist, right, the main character, or if you are in an auxiliary role, so you're chosen to play, you know, the mom, the dad, etc., or if you're just in the audience. Mm-hmm. It doesn't matter, because whether you're watching it or whether you're in a role or whether you're in the protagonist role, healing is happening on all of those levels. So if you're a little bit nervous at first and you don't want to put yourself forward, that's absolutely fine. You can come and you can watch, and you will still get something out of it, just like when we go to the movies or we see a play sure. and it really touches us. You will relate to it.
Well, and it's also even in the as an audience member. So the person who's the protagonist, you know, that's their drama and they're doing work with anxiety when their relationship at work. And they're doing that and they have somebody be anxiety and somebody be boss and somebody be criticism, whatever. And then you have two people in the audience. A lot of this stuff are really, you know, themes that we all can relate to in one way or another. You know, it's not like, well, I don't have a boss. I'm self-employed. Like, there's something about it that you can relate to. So even in the audience, you do get, again, one of the pieces of psychodrama is a new perspective. Because it's not just in your head. You might see it out like, oh, man, like, that's what I do. So you're just sitting there and you're like, that is exactly, oh, man. And then so there is no way where you don't have some healing or some change or some new insight, which is really great, because I think some people think like, oh, well, I didn't get picked and I'm just going to be sitting here and who cares? But you just never know. And also in the role of auxiliary, you know, being, oh, pick somebody to, you know, John, Jane Doe, whoever, pick somebody to be your anxiety, and they get brought up and maybe that's something they need to work on. Or the example that I often think of is pick somebody to be your anger, and that, you know, some people are really good at anger and they need to work more on sadness, or some people, it's really hard for them to voice anger, but being in the role where they're not the main person there, they can get into that and have that where they can voice things and be able to do things they're not normally comfortable enough to do.
Absolutely right. So someone who might be struggling to express anger in their own lives might actually get picked to play the role of someone's anger. And so they would then, again, try on a new role, right? The role of anger and expression of anger. And so that could be really healing for them because they would learn something by being someone else's anger. And also you were talking about the audience. And so being in the audience, an important part of that is that you're witnessing, you're bearing witness to the story that's on the stage. And that's really important because Moreno also spoke about how we need to be witnessed. And we need to be witnessed with all of our feelings, all of our, you know, crud. And that's why I often tell my group members, that's why, like, going and crying by yourself in the bathroom, you're going to feel better in the short term, but not the long term, because sure. nobody has witnessed those tears. And we have to be witnessed. And some of us have those friends that see us, I say, sort of snot and all. And other people, though, don't. And so they don't get witnessed. And so group is a way that they can be in an authentic place and be witnessed. And so that audience plays a very crucial part to the group, because they bear witness to their story. And just having someone bear witness is very, very powerful. And then there's the part where they can relate, like you were saying, and say, oh my gosh, I do that. Or they might relate not to the protagonist, but the other role. So I've had a mom in the group who will see a drama maybe about a mom and a daughter. And then instead of relating to the mom, she'll say, oh my gosh, I really connected.
Sure. Yeah, absolutely.
With the daughter. That's how I felt when I was a daughter. Or I imagine that's how my daughter is feeling now.
Absolutely.
With me.
Yeah.
And again, you step outside of yourself, and it's very, very powerful.
Yeah, because I think when I'm pitching it to folks and talking to them about when I refer to your group, and just in talking about it even in session, that I think people get stuck on, you know, I got to go for the big thing. You know, I got to go. I'm here to work on that dynamic with dad. You know, or I'm here to deal with the traumas that happened, the car crash, sex abuse, whatever. And instead kind of expanding your scope that, like, that's not the only thing. We're very complex beings, that it might be, again, you know, it's a lot of stuff. I know in my own experience in psychodrama and from working with folks about, like, man, I was thinking this and I totally didn't realize this whole other thing. You know, like, they're ready to go guns blazing toward dad and dad's treatment of them, and then suddenly they're like, wow, there's this whole other piece about mom that comes out in the drama, or in again, them being the dad, or them in the auxiliary, or them in the audience, like, wow, there's a whole other thing here where you can grow from that, because it's not just the showdown showcase. It's not like, you know, let's write a list of all the people you want to tell what's what. That might be a drama, but there's thousands of permutations from there out that is helpful to help people heal from these injuries, these injuries in relationships.
Absolutely. And that's the key point, right? It's healing in relationship. And Marina also said we get injured in relationships and we heal in relationships. Yeah. And so we need to experience the relationships, and sometimes we need to practice that on the stage before we can practice it and feel safe enough to practice it in our actual relationships. And that's another really important part about psychodrama, that psychodrama can be used really for anything, right? So you can have a conversation with your anxiety, with, you know, your cancer diagnosis, with your dad, with someone who passed. It doesn't matter. You can also look at something we call role training. So training a certain role that is not yet strengthened. So maybe mm-hmm. the role of confidence or assertiveness. You know, someone might come in and say, you know, every time I go and talk to my boss, I get really anxious. I'm not feeling confident. I want to strengthen that role. Or someone might say, I really need to be more assertive with my mother-in-law, and I don't know how to do that. And so psychodrama also lets them practice that, practice new skills until they become really comfortable and part of their own role.
That's a piece about, you know, again, part of the point of this is not just it's not just feeling better. It's about, you know, having, you may have a catharsis where you're able to get angry, you're able to cry, but it's also the change in your behavior outside of the fact, or outside of the fact, outside of the room. So you go in group and it might be voicing something to your a sibling that died. You know, and they've been dead for 6 years, 7 years, or whatever, and you're able to voice all those things. It obviously, you know, in reality, sibling is still dead. So it's, you know, I think some people are like, well, what's the point of that? Well, you know, whatever, they're still dead, it doesn't matter. But I think it's complex in the sense that not only are they feeling better about that, but it might, and you're talking about the role part, about maybe that helps them be more assertive. So it's not just, oh, you deal with that grief and you're good to go. It is about the changes that happen outside. You don't have how life changes when you don't have that kind of burden of these feelings and these issues and these injuries that haven't been dealt with. So even in the context of this person being like, oh, I was finally able to say to my sister, brother, whoever, you know, I was really mad at them for their, let's say they died of a drug overdose. Like, I was really mad about them for their drug use and that they never listened to me. And then again, the person's still deceased. So after that, you know, what's their life like if they don't have crushing grief, you know, or guilt that they might start interacting different with their partner? They might start interacting different at work or at school or whoever. Does that make sense? That kind of that it's not just about feeling better, that there's many ways where change can happen outside of the room. Oh man, what a good question. And if you are waiting to hear the answer to that question, you'll have to wait a little longer. This is where episode one of this two-parter on psychodrama will end. Such suspense. What a cliffhanger. Next episode, which will air in 2 weeks, Dr. Brittany Lakenstar will answer that question and talk about what happens in psychodrama, not only the change in the room, but change outside of the room. We're going to go in greater detail about that. We're also going to be talking about another example of psychodrama. We're going to talk about more details about how that works in group. We'll see how she fares in the lightning round. What are her questions? Who would she want to see in therapy? What are the things that she thinks are the core mechanisms of change in therapy? And we'll just have to see and check in. We'll also be talking about a piece about, so we talked about the first two pieces of a drama, about the warm-up and some of the dramatic work, but we have yet to talk about the third piece, the sharing. How do you wrap up dramatic work? So tune in next time. You will hear the second half of that episode. Hopefully enjoy, and we will get into that in a few weeks. Thank you for listening. Again, I am at Twitter at 50MH Podcast. That's at 50MH Podcast. Please, if you have a moment, write a review, rate the show on iTunes. That is very much appreciated. Tell your friends, tell your family, talk about it at your local barbershop. That's the end of the episode. So remember, together, we're heavy.